Greetings and Sarabindinous revelations, my punctacious listeners, and welcome to this February 2014 Science News Update. I'm your host for this stunningly stunny science podcast segment, Jim Campanella. Wow, my podcasts are seldom broadcast at the beginning of the month, and it seems like a year since I last spoke to you all. Well, since the last science news was January 1st, it's actually been almost 2 months. Well, I have many stories I have gathered in that time, and I shall try to tell you the most interesting in the short time that I have with you. The first story of the night is about horizontal genetic transfer. I know that sounds like part of a dirty joke, but let me explain. One of the things I always talk about in my genetics classes is about the process of horizontal and vertical transfer of genetic information. Most organisms, like a cat, a dog, a human, etc., only have vertical transfer of information. That can be defined as passing along information generationally through sex. Father and mother have children. Or you can even have vertical transfer in species like yeast or bacteria, who just split into daughter cells. The daughter cells are the next generation with the information of the previous generation. While vertical transfer is what we are most familiar with, there is also something called horizontal transfer. That is picking up genetic information from other members of the same generation as you are without reproduction. Bacteria do this all the time, and it's why we have such trouble now with bacteria that are resistant to antibiotics. Resistant bacteria have passed those genes on to other members of the same generation which were not resistant. Well, in more complex organisms, that kind of horizontal gene transfer or pilfering is rather rare. You almost never see it in animals, and even in plants it's pretty rare. Apparently, one of the most interesting exceptions to that observation is in the plant Amborella trichopoda. Amborella is a large evergreen bush or small tree that grows up to about 20 feet in height. The only common name that I could find for it is Amborella, which tells you that the only people who have actually noticed it are scientists. It holds an interesting position among flowering plants because based on its DNA sequence, it acts as a missing link between the gymnosperms, pines, spruces, etc., and all flowering plants, that is the angiosperms, which evolved afterwards. The species represents a line of flowering plants that diverged very early on in evolution, maybe 130 million years ago, from all the other living species of flowering plants, at the very base of the genealogical tree of living flowering plants. Now researchers describe the plant's genes in detail, and it turns out that the species is even more odd than was thought originally. Amborella seems to be a major player in the use of horizontal gene transfer from other species. Dr. Jeffrey Palmer of Indiana University published a paper at the end of December in the journal Science, which finds that Amborella has captured not just pieces, but whole genomes from three different kinds of algae and a moss. Even more interesting, these captured genes aren't in Amborella's cell nucleus, but in the separate genome of the mitochondria, that is the little powerhouse of the cell. Palmer says, quote, "The genes that Amborella swallowed now outnumber its original mitochondrial ones 6-to-1, but so far, tests find little evidence that the hoarded DNA still works. It's an anal retentive genome," unquote. You may scoff and say this finding seems rather unimportant, but what is amazing about Amborella is the sheer scale of the transfer and the evolutionary distance between the species. Amborella's incorporation of whole genomes fits with a so-called fusion scenario to explain how mitochondria manage their heists. It used to be in old textbooks that mitochondria were described as tidy, self-contained little capsules in cells, but this view has gone away in recent years as modern imaging techniques show them routinely fusing into tubes and branches. Since the plant's mitochondria can fuse with each other, Palmer thinks that they might also fuse with the mitochondria and algae and moss draping the shrub's branches, and so borrow DNA from them. Palmer's work also shows how uneven the results of gene stealing can be. Jean's and Ambarella's nucleus don't show such a trove of stolen goods. That discrepancy makes it tricky to judge the role of genetic thievery in evolution. As if Palmer's paper was not enough, another paper in the same issue of Science from Dr. Douglas Soltis of University of Florida looked at the nuclear genome of Ambarella, and he found that the plant contains repeated genes, which indicates that ancestral flowering plants must have duplicated their whole genomes early in their history. Soltis says, quote, "That doubling may help answer how flowering plants came to rule the terrestrial landscape over the whole Earth and do so much better than gymnosperms. Further genome doubling became common later in the evolution of flowering plants as a way that new species formed. It can help organisms take advantage of new opportunities. With extra copies around, some genes keep doing their old job while others are repurposed for some brave new world," unquote. The next story is a quick exoplanet update. For the first time, it was reported in the journal Nature back in January that astronomers from the University of Chicago have used the Hubble Space Telescope to observe the weather on a super-Earth exoplanet orbiting a distant star. The team was led by Dr. Laura Kreidberg. Conditions on GJ1214b are cloudy, with an atmosphere so thick with water vapor or some other heavy molecule that observations of the planet's surface are nearly impossible. GJ1214b is the smallest and most Earth-like world yet to yield the secrets of its atmosphere, and its analysis suggests that clouds may be a common feature in many exoplanets that are out there. You may remember that super-Earths are planets that are larger than Earth but smaller than Neptune, and they seem to be among the most common planets in the Milky Way. Kreidberg says, quote, "Those clouds would be unlike any on Earth, given the temperatures and pressures in the exoplanet's atmosphere. They could be made of zinc sulfide, for example, or potassium chloride, as both of those compounds would condense into microscopic droplets and thus form clouds under such conditions. It's the first time we've been able to characterize the atmosphere of an exoplanet smaller than Neptune," unquote. To compile their forecast, Kreidberg's team analyzed 96 hours of telescope time over 11 months. I guess that their patience was rewarded. Here's another space story. The NASA Jet Propulsion Laboratory issued a press release on February 5th announcing that sometime between July 2010 and May 2012, a really big space rock slammed into Mars. That is a quote, by the way, a really big space rock. An image of the resulting crater released February 5th by NASA shows a scar about 30 meters across, which for us Americans is about 90 feet. According to NASA, impacts apparently are not uncommon on the Red Planet, which gets hit by more than 200 asteroids or comets every year. But very few of those crashes leave such visible craters as big as 10 automobiles laid end to end. And actually, there was even more damage than that. The photograph, available on the JPL website, was taken November 19, 2013, by the high-res imaging camera on NASA's Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. Based on the blue and black blast zone that appears to explode from the crater, astronomers have estimated that the impact threw material as far as 15 kilometers away. Now, I know what you're thinking. Egads, 200 impacts a year. If Mars gets more than 200 impacts per year, why isn't this also the case for Earth? Well, it's actually not that complicated. I mean, it is the same for Earth. We're just better protected. Our atmosphere burns up most of those falling bits of space matter. And also, we're protected by the larger area that people don't live on, that is, the oceans. Most of those bits land in the oceans and not necessarily on land. Any longtime listener to this podcast segment will know that I have talked for years about being able to wipe bad memories from the human mind. Traumas often last a lifetime, and many people would be grateful for release from that pain. There have been a number of breakthroughs in this field over the years that I have reported. I think that this next story is just the latest and most promising of all my reports. In a study published in January in the journal Cell, Dr. Li Hua Tsai of MIT found that compounds called histone deacetylase inhibitors can weaken long-term fear memories in mice when combined with exposure-based therapy. These compounds interfere with the function of the enzymes that remove acetyl chemical groups from histones. Histones are the proteins around which DNA is wrapped. So by removing those acetyl groups, it allows them to wrap the DNA more tightly and close it up so that it cannot be read and activated. Loosening up the DNA increases the access of transcription-initiating enzymes to genes involved in memory and learning. So tightening it up helps to remove memories and forget, presumably. This process could have stable, broad, and long-lasting effects on gene expression, potentially making it suitable for permanently modifying traumatic memories, as you find in post-traumatic stress disorder. In this new study, Tsai repeatedly exposed mice to a sound tone paired up with a foot shock at the same time. Every time the tone was heard by itself, the mice would later freeze in fear. Initially, to get rid of that sensitivity, the researchers repeatedly exposed the mice to the tone without delivering the foot shock. When this process took place one day after the mice were exposed to the tone shock pairing, it was effective at reducing the fear response to the tone. However, if the researchers waited up to a month before delivering the treatment, it was not effective. That was presumably after the mice learned to associate the tone with the shock. The memory was in their heads and it was pretty much going nowhere. On the other hand, that exposure-based therapy combined with inhibitor treatment was effective at reducing fear. Even when given 1 month after the mice were exposed to the tone shock pairing, it was actually quite effective. Moreover, inhibitor treatment increased the expression of genes that affect the communication between neurons in the hippocampus, a brain region that plays a crucial role in learning and memory. It would seem this should work like a dream, inject and they forget. However, nothing is ever that easy. Histone deacetylase inhibitor treatment alone did not produce the changes in gene expression or the behavioral benefits in mice with one-month-old fear memories. It was only effective if the researchers combined the cognitive, behavioral, and pharmacological strategies together to effectively treat the traumatic memories. As far as I know, this is the first report of a successful effort to attenuate remote fear responses in an animal model of fear memories. It may have a long-lasting impact on the treatment of not just soldiers, but people who have been traumatized by slightly more prosaic scariness at home. The next two stories fall into a category that you might call nutraceutical stories. That is, foods that recently have been found to be better for you than you may have suspected. Well, first up, we always knew that milk does the body good, as the commercials say, but it may do us more good than we ever knew. Milk has been long touted for its nutritional value, since it is a natural source of protein, calcium, phosphorus, and a bunch of other vitamins required by the human body. In addition, mother's milk is prized for playing a key role in the development of the infant immune system. But aside from nutrition, in recent years, milk has gained recognition as a rich source of potentially therapeutic proteins and peptides. In particular, short proteins in milk have been demonstrated to have a variety of functions, such as antimicrobial, antiviral, antioxidant, immunostimulatory activity, and antihypertension activities. Milk peptides have also been used to treat Alzheimer's disease and have even been used as morphine-like pain receptor blockers. These peptides are embedded in native milk proteins and can be released via protease cleavage. According to a study in the journal Dairy Science last month by Dr. W.J. Chen of Taiwan University, a peptide derived from milk is effective at killing gastric cancer cells. Gastric cancer is one of the most deadly forms of cancer, with about 21,000 new cases diagnosed and about 10,000 associated deaths in the U.S. every year. The short peptide called lactoferricin B25 was derived from a longer peptide found in cow's milk called lactoferrin, which is known as an antimicrobial agent. When incubated with gastric cancer cells, the smaller peptide reduced cell viability by inducing pre-programmed cell death in the cancer cells. The concept for the study stemmed from earlier findings which demonstrated that ionic antimicrobial peptides including lactoferrin, could selectively bind to and disrupt cancer cell membranes without conferring subsequent drug resistance. Another study in the journal Food and Function last month from the lab of Dr. R.J. Fitzgerald of the University of Limerick suggested that dipeptides could be released by enzymatic digestion of milk proteins that inhibit dipeptidyl peptidase 4. That is an enzyme which is involved in glucose metabolism. Inhibition of that dipeptidyl peptidase results in an increase in the levels of the hormones glucagon-like peptide 1 and glucose-dependent insulinotropic polypeptide. Increases in those two enzymes leads to suppression of appetite and increased survival of the beta cells in the pancreas. Those are the ones that secrete insulin. This all results in better health and lowered blood glucose levels. The authors of these studies suggest that biofunctional hydroxylates could be used to release bioactive dipeptides from milk proteins in the development of novel type 2 diabetes treatments. At this point, listeners are rushing to their fridges and chugging gallons of milk. Please don't. You have got to remember that even though those hormones and enzymes are present in milk, they are not exactly present in huge amounts. In addition to that, they're bound up to other proteins. Both the scientific studies spent a good deal of time isolating those products from gallons and gallons of milk or using cloning methods to express them artificially at high concentrations in bacterial cells. Unfortunately, there is little evidence right now that they will either prevent cancer or diabetes at the concentrations that you would find in a normal glass or two of milk a day that most people would drink. But at least it's nice to know that for once, I don't have bad news about something that we eat every day. The second food story is about cranberries. I guess this would have been more appropriate back during the holidays in December or even November around Thanksgiving, but here we are, a couple of months away from that. I didn't even come across this news until the last couple of weeks. The study from December was published in the journal Food Chemistry by Dr. Katarzyna Kowalska's lab at Poznan University of Life Sciences in Poland. Kowalska found that cranberries reduce the generation of fat cells and make those cells slimmer as well. Kowalska says, quote, "These results are the first to point out the anti-adipogenic properties of cranberries. Generally, we should eat fruits and vegetables, but it's good to know which of them exhibit anti-adipogenic properties," unquote. Anti-adipogenic properties means they keep fat from forming. Wahoo! Cranberries grow wild throughout the marshy North American New England coast and were a staple of Native American cooking before the Europeans arrived here. They are also a major crop in my present home of New Jersey here. For years, researchers have known that cranberries are packed with healthful compounds, from vitamins to minerals to polyphenols, and they've investigated cranberries' effect on numerous human conditions, such as urinary tract infections and cardiovascular diseases. But Kowalska was curious about whether they had any effect on fat. So she and her team gathered Polish cranberries, and the species name is Vaccinium oxycoccus, and these are in the same genus as the American berries, Vaccinium macrocarpus, but they bear smaller, pale pink berries with a sharp, acidic flavor. The researchers added varying concentrations of a solution made from freeze-dried powdered cranberries dissolved in cell culture media in mouse preadipocytes. Those are cells which are destined to become fat cells. After 48 hours, they saw an effect. Preadipocyte proliferation slowed and the cells became less viable directly in proportion to the concentration of the powdered cranberries used in the culture media. Kowalska then stimulated differentiation of the preadipocytes into mature adipocytes and found that high doses of cranberry solution reduced the viability of mature adipocytes and also increased production of reactive oxygen species that are known to play a role in programmed cell death. Additionally, when cranberry solution was added to preadipocytes actively maturing into full-blown fat cells, the cell number, viability, and metabolic activity dwindled depending on the cranberry concentration. The resulting adipocytes also contained less fat. Cranberries stimulated the breakdown of fat in mature adipocytes as well, depending on concentration, and also appear to inhibit lipogenesis in the first place. The molecular mechanism for all this is still unclear. So Kowalska used molecular methods to find that the cranberry solution suppressed expression of those specific genes that induce differentiation of the pre-adipocytes into fully mature fat cells. So which one of the many biologically active compounds in cranberries was at work here? Well, the researchers theorize that quercetin may play a role. Cranberries contain as much as 25 milligrams of quercetin per 100 grams of fresh fruit. And other studies have shown that the compound prevents proliferation and can induce apoptosis, programmed cell death, in cell cultures. Previous research has also shown that quercetin interferes with the process of adipogenesis by interacting with the transcription factors mentioned above. Another possibility are anthocyanins, the red pigment about which I actually just published an evolutionary biology research paper last month, and they've also been shown to inhibit proliferation of pre-adipocytes and fat cells, adipocytes. However, Kowalska says, quote, "It is more likely that the many polyphenols in cranberries all work together, and it is not just one," unquote. The researchers emphasize that they need to conduct animal and clinical studies to know for sure whether cranberries' effects will extend beyond the lab, but for now, enjoying a bit of the berries in your stuffing or salsa can't hurt. Stay away from the sauces, though, with lots of sugar, however. Kowalska says, quote, "The best will be fresh fruits or frozen fruits or low-caloric juices. Probably once we add sugar to the cranberries, we change any of the anti-obesity power of this fruit," unquote. For those of you who love the Winter Olympic Games, game theory, and statistical analysis, you're going to be intrigued by the next story. According to Dr. Eric Zitzewitz of Dartmouth University, we are going to be in for some interesting skate judging during the Winter Olympics in Sochi, Russia. The Olympics are in full swing while I record this story and should be over at the end of the month when you hear it. The story from the February issue of the Journal of Sports Economics may have you rethinking some of the matchups and their results afterwards. Zizowitz says that judging scandals from the past may haunt us and get even worse. At the 2002 Winter Olympics, five judges allegedly arranged to rank a Russian figure skating pair first in exchange for the Russian judge giving high scores in other skating events to athletes from the colluding countries. In response to that and other judging scandals, the International Skating Union decided to stop reporting which member of a judging panel issued which score. Anonymity was seen as a way to discourage vote trading. Zitzewitz says that anonymity caused the reverse to occur. Favoritism towards skaters from one's own country and vote trading jointly increased by about 20% after judges went incognito. The research reports that although the 20% increase is not a statistically significant rise relative to corruption levels observed in 2002, it's still potentially enough to alter the results of close competitions. Zitzewitz previously estimated that in the 2002 Winter Olympics, figure skaters moved up about two places in the final standings if a judge from their home country sat on the scoring panel. He says, quote, "Making judges' votes secret in Winter Games held since 2002 further increased home country favoritism. I recommend reinstating public disclosure of each judge's scores. If the sport provided an easily accessible database, independent researchers could check for signs of bias and corruption. Additionally, a statistically savvy review committee would help keep judges honest," unquote. Zitzewitz analyzed judging from three data sets of major figure skating championships and events, including the Olympics. His first data set was the pre-reform data covering 16 competitions from 2000 to 2002. At that time, judges' identities were posted and majority rule determined skaters' placements. A second data set covered 23 events from 2002 to 2004 in which the judges' identities were kept secret. Scores of several judges on each panel were dropped at random to discourage vote trading. A third data set consisted of 107 events from 2003 to 2009. Further rule changes included having judges combine objective ratings of the difficulty of a skater's program with subjective scores for skating skills and other aspects of a skater's performance. So what did he find? Well, in the pre-reform samples, Zisowitz found that judges tended to give higher scores to competitors from their own countries. Skaters also benefited when a judge from their own country sat on a panel at the same event for a skating competition other than their own, an indirect sign of vote trading. After 2002, skaters' scores rose further when they were judged by panels that included a compatriot. Skaters also continue to benefit at events where judges for competitions other than their own included someone from their homeland. Zisowitz says, quote, "Selection procedures for Olympic figure skating judges need to change, perhaps taking a nod from another judged winter sport like ski jumping. Those judges were selected by Ski Jumping Central Committee for the 2002 Olympics and showed little or no bias or vote trading," unquote. I want to end the night talking about one of those ideas that I swear has been in SF for like 70 years. Telling you this story means that I will have to move back into the realm of hardcore particle physics for the end of my segment, which I have to admit makes me a bit nervous because it is certainly not my forte in any way. Additionally, I did not realize until recently that one of my old friends from grad school at University of Chicago, and a one-time roommate, is a listener and contributor to the show, Dr. Rob Scherer, now chair of physics at Vanderbilt University. Rob, be patient with whatever naivete that I fall into here. I know I'm a geneticist and not a physical scientist at all, but sometimes stories are so cool that you just have to pass them along. So Dr. David S. Hall from Amherst College and his group of researchers reported in the journal Nature this month that they have made a synthetic monopole. Listeners may remember that magnets all have a south and a north pole. Well, a monopole is an atomic particle that has a magnetic charge on it, not an electric charge on it. The existence of the particle was theorized 80 years ago by physicist Paul Dirac, one of the founders of quantum physics. Anybody who's been reading SF for a long time knows that whenever some hack writer wants to come up with a way of making an anti-gravity device or some new kind of hyperdrive, they very often invoke things like monopoles. The particle itself is a point source with just a single magnetic pole, as opposed to having two poles. That seems like a weird idea when we consider our everyday experience with magnets. So we've all taken full-size bar magnets and noticed that their ends either attract or repel one another. And again, the ends are the poles, and every magnet has one end that is a north pole and the other that is a south pole. Opposites attract. That is, a magnetic north pole attracts a magnetic south pole. But the same pole repels from one another. For example, north and north repel and south repel. Magnetism is a little like electric charges in chemistry or physics, which exhibit the same attractive and repulsive behavior involving positive and negative charges. Now, if you take a bar magnet and break it in half, you do not get a monopole. You simply get two smaller magnets, each with a north and a south pole. Now, the really cool thing is, it doesn't matter how many times you divide a magnet down and break it in half, you can keep breaking it down to the molecular level, and you will always have a north pole and a south pole. There's no way to make a solitary pole or monopole that acts as a single point source of the magnetic field by simply breaking your magnet into something smaller and smaller and smaller. Now, no natural monopoles have yet been discovered by particle physicists. My reading suggests that the energy of a single magnetic monopole is theoretically so huge that if it were completely used to recharge a battery of, like, an electric car, the vehicle could travel for kilometers and kilometers. I mean, that suggests why no one has yet seen a magnetic monopole in a particle accelerator. It simply has such a huge amount of energy in it. I'm surprised the military is not funding more research in the area. I mean, one background paper that I read suggested that if the mass of a magnetic monopole really is as big as they think, the energy released from the collision of a negatively and positively charged monopole would be as much as the energy released in the explosion of a kilogram of dynamite. In 2009, Aalto University researchers Ville Pietilä and Mikko Motonen, the eventual collaborators with David Hall, published theoretical results demonstrating a method to create Dirac monopoles in a Bose-Einstein condensate. Now, a Bose-Einstein condensate is sometimes considered to be the fifth state of matter, in addition to solid, liquid, gas, and plasma. In this condensate, the importance and location of individual atoms becomes kind of vague, and the system behaves as if it were a single large atom. Piatila and Muotoinen's idea involved using external magnetic fields to rotate the atomic spins of these particles. A Dirac monopole would form in the condensate as a result of the spin rotation. Now, I admit, I don't entirely understand that. But that was the method that was actually adopted by Hall and his colleagues to create the synthetic magnetic monopole. The Dirac monopole forms in the artificial magnetic field of the condensate, not in the physical magnetic field, which steers the spin degree of freedom. Thus, a natural magnetic monopole is not needed to create the synthetic monopole. I really find this kind of story so neat because I heard of monopoles so many years ago when I started reading SF as a kid, but frankly, except for basic research into the further nature of quantum physics, I am not sure what the creation of a monopole means. I suspect in the long run, it may not give us flying cars, force fields, low energy wormholes, or faster ways to get to Mars. But that's no reason not to dream. I guess my ignorance of quantum physics really helps me to imagine all sorts of things are possible sometimes. Well, that's all from me for now. As always, take care. Remember to chow down on those sugar-free cranberries so you can keep your cute girlish figures. And I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.